I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Frank McKenna, Beyond Politics, is a new book from the journalist and author Harvey Soller. It's an interesting account of one of Canada's highly respected politicians and now business leaders. With remarkable access to McKenna and the insights of many of McKenna's contemporaries, as well as figures such as former prime ministers and presidents, it's a telling book about a man who was a successful criminal lawyer, becoming premier of New Brunswick, a job he held for 10 years, who left it to pursue a further career in business and the diplomatic corps, capping off his post-political life as Canadian ambassador to the United States. McKenna is now the deputy chair of TD Bank Financial Group, and though he was within reach of the leadership of the Liberal Party twice, and he twice turned it down, one suspects his name might arise again. Harvey Soller joins me now to discuss McKenna and this book, which is published by Douglas & McIntyre. He is also a well-known tourism consultant. His website is harveysoller.com. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Harvey Soller. Good morning, Mr. Soller.
Hi, Joe. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us. Where are you this morning?
I'm in St. John, New Brunswick.
You live on PEI, right?
I live in Charlotte, just outside of Charlottetown in a little place called Bellevue Cove, but I am on the road doing some tourism consulting and some book signings this week, sort of combining things, so trying to make hay, kill two birds with one stone, you know.
In New Brunswick, is McKenna still popular?
Unbelievable, really. We had a book signing in Moncton on the 13th of the November, and people were lined up there for 35, 40 minutes with their books in hand. And but the interesting thing is, because I joined him at the table there, is that people just... everybody has a McKenna story. They all want to tell them his story, and they all want to tell them about their connection to him in one way or another, either through community or relatives or directly. And so, yeah, he's got a strong following, and it's almost as though some people worship him to a degree. That sounds a little extreme, but it's not an exaggeration when you're sitting there watching these people come up, and they just want so badly to talk to him and share.
I suppose everyone wants to know what his future is. Is he happy at TD?
Well, I think he's happy with the blend of things he's doing. I think if you just, in the isolation of is he happy at TD, I mean, the company's been fabulous to him. He's been very clear about that. It's the combination of things he's doing that I think is keeping him content, but he still admits not to the same degree as public life in the other respects. So it's the combination of TD, together with his philanthropic activities, together with his speech making across the country, together with his own private businesses, you know. So it's and plus, you know, he still has a bit of a voice in the media, and I think he doesn't seek out interviews, but when they come, I think he still enjoys putting his voice to things. Like in the last week or two, he's been pretty vocal about some of the Liberal Party stuff that's been going on versus the Conservatives, but he has to balance that against his role at the bank. So,
is it your sense as a journalist that that Ignatieff's leadership, Michael Ignatieff, the leader of the Liberal Party, that his leadership could come apart soon and McKenna would seek the job?
Let me put it two ways, Joe. Mr. McKenna would stand behind Ignatieff, and he has in several interviews, and he did in the book, professing that, you know, he's extremely intellectual and a proud Canadian and wants to do the best. From my point of view, certainly Mr. Ignatieff seems a little shaky. Would, if he goes down in sort of Dion-esque fashion or something like that, would McKenna go? I don't know. I think it would take a greater crisis than that. There would have to be an almost absolute assurance or belief on his part that Harper would not win, Prime Minister Harper would not win a majority, because he has no intentions of sitting in opposition. So there would have to be so many pluses lined up before Mr. McKenna, I think, would take that kind of a leap.
How did you come to write this book? Because as you've said that you've been at sidings with him, we've seen him on television talking about the book. One assumes that you were commissioned to write this.
No, I chased him down, and he took a couple few months to think about it. From the fall of 07 into 08, and then when he agreed, we started doing the work and conducting, you know, doing the interviews and so forth. So, I chased him down, and I just, you know, conscious of subjects. I had done the Irving book a couple of years prior, and then I did a book on the last Canadian beer, which is really an examination of Moosehead and its phenomena in North America and really around the world to some degree, who said beer. And I don't know, I looked it back on his 2001 biography by Philip Lee, and I just felt it was time for an update because so much had gone under the bridge, you know, in terms of the ambassadorship and the pursuits two times of him to become prime minister on the part of so many people, both in the media and the public. Plus, he was active in so many fronts with Bill Clinton and George Bush and Tony Blair, and he was just using so many fronts, it was almost irresistible. So he thought about it, and he finally agreed.
Well, in terms of the access that you got, were there any sort of conditions, like you couldn't talk about this, that, or the other?
No, and in every other case I've done a book, there's always been some conditions, you know, certainly with the Irvings, who are very, they do not like to be exposed media-wise at all, although they did, one of the Irvings did cooperate in the book, and in the end, he did, which was J.K. Irving, the patriarch of the family. I've always run into some kind of a caveat, or let's not discuss that, but with Mr. McKenna, there was no such discussion.
And I guess it's just worked out that he's liked the book.
Well, I mean, I did clear some fact-checking back and forth with him and a VP of his, who was also mentioned in the book, James Dodds, you know, because there was some accuracy issues I needed to make sure about family things and things like that. You know, but I think I had a consciousness of sort of where the line was, even though there wasn't one, and I think that line, the only one that might have been there that I sort of maybe created for myself, was not to push him too hard on the leadership question, even though I asked it several different ways, and he gave me handwritten notes from his time in Washington where he had analyzed running or not. I guess I just kind of sensed that you can only ask the question so many times before you might test somebody's patience, and so maybe I restrained myself a bit in that regard, but he likes the book. I'm sure there's some things in there about the Meech Lake discussion and the analysis from a guy named Chris Sands in Washington about his time as ambassador, and Alan Gottlieb's analysis of that he would have rather not seen there, but I think he's okay with the book. Yeah.
I've never written a book, and so I'm wondering, when you attempt a biography of someone, do you have to like the person? And in the case of McKenna, I'm not a liberal, and I probably wouldn't vote liberal ever in my life, but he just seems very likable. Did you have to like him to want to do this book?
No, you have to be fascinated with them. You don't have to like them.
Yeah.
And I've been fascinated with, I think, all the subjects I've done, certainly. You know, I was no sooner did we have a, we weren't, well, we hadn't even launched this book, and I was in pursuit of Peter McKay in terms of doing a book, and he's declined that opportunity for the time being. So, you know, I'm fascinated by Mr. McKay in terms of his probable climb through the ranks at some point in the future in the Conservative Party. And I thought it would be an interesting thing to get ahead of that curve. But so in that case and other subjects that I'm currently considering, I'm fascinated with them versus necessarily having to, you know, like them. So it's probably a balance between admiration and an interest.
McKenna's life as a lawyer, that was a successful career as a criminal lawyer, right?
It was. You know, he had a fate of fortune in that he ended up being the criminal lawyer for a guy named Yvon Durell, who was a heavyweight contender internationally. And, you know, it was a murder trial and so forth, and it became a nationally publicized trial. So it kind of vaunted Mr. McKenna's name out there. But certainly in New Brunswick, it gave him a profile that was really unmatched by any other criminal lawyer, for sure. So by the time he began to run, the constant reference back to the Durell trial sort of made him a bit of the hero or the everyman, because Durell was sort of an everyman kind of perceived victim in that trial, even though he did commit the killing. It was the circumstances were that it was not guilty of manslaughter or murder.
How early was it for McKenna that he knew that he wanted to go into politics, that he wanted to be a leader?
Well, he was active at St. Evex politically in the student union, and he was involved early on with Alan McKechnie's office. So, you know, from the time of his late teens, early 20s, he certainly had an eye towards organizations of a political type, if not liberal party per se. But pretty quickly, early on, he was involved in Alan McEachran's work, both in Ottawa terms, an organization of political parties, as well as on the ground in Nova Scotia and Cape Breton. So he got both sides. It was the strategic planning of a political party, as well as the, you know, making sure that, as the book says, the RCMP buy their gas at a certain gas station that's owned by a liberal in Cape Breton Island. So, you know, he got both sides of the equation and the dose of reality that way in the political sense.
When he won 57 out of 57 seats in that election in 1987, was that how much of that was on based on his own personal popularity in New Brunswick?
Well, I think very much so. I think that Premier Hatfield had approximately about a 17-year run. So change was inevitable no matter what, but the extremity of the win, taking every single seat in the legislature, as Peter Lougheed said, he was jealous of McKenna, jokingly jealous, because he had destroyed Lougheed's record. I think Lougheed was two seats short of a majority, absolute legislature ownership back in his time. Hard to say.
Well, he promised that he would stay on as premier for 10 years, and he did that. What does that say about his character?
Well, what it says about his character is that, well, what it does is it puts him in a position that his character for everything he wanted to do after that was that people were more prepared to believe him than any other politician. So, for example, he says also in the book that if he had decided to go, he would have said at the advent of his term or in election campaigning, he said, I would run for one term, like 4 to 5 years, and I would leave, which would focus everybody's energy on the task at hand instead of how to get him reelected in 5 years. He's probably the only Canadian politician that could have said that and gotten away with it or been believed because of what he did with the 10-year run in New Brunswick. There's a number of people in the book who remain astonished, especially some Americans, at the fact that he said he was going to go, and he did go, because from their point of view, there's no such thing as a politician who can bear to leave office.
In terms of New Brunswick politics, how transformative was he in his 10 years as premier?
Well, I think, you know, there were a string of premiers that were transformative. I think Louis J. Robichaud in the 60s, certainly Mr. Hatfield did certain things in his time, and when there were agreements happening between Ottawa and the Maritime Provinces for transfer payments and so forth. So in those cases, you know, somewhere between their charisma, their leadership, and access to resources, there was a degree of transformation taking place. What happened in the McKenna era, I believe, is that it was magnified and accelerated because of his leadership style. And you know, before, at the time that he came in, there was still a viewpoint about New Brunswick externally and inside New Brunswick that there was the province was a second-rate place. And his aspiration, and he succeeded definitely in this, was in improving New Brunswick's self-esteem, which was, you know, as it is for an individual, if you improve a province's self-esteem or the public's self-esteem, then they're going to go on to better things, and so that if nothing else, that's what he did. Some people mock the McKenna miracle, as it was called, but I guess my response to that might be that during Premier Lord's time, there was no such kind of a radical transition. You don't hear anybody talking about the Lord miracle.
You talked to Brian Mulroney, and a lot of what you talked about had to do with the Meechel Lake Accord and McKenna's effect there. Well, what did McKenna do there? What did Mulroney think of McKenna and Meechel Lake?
If there was one word, I would say respect. It's mutual. They respect one another greatly, I would say. If you read Mulroney's memoirs, there are points in there at which he doesn't hesitate to recant every flaw, whether it's relative to Mr. McKenna or, well, it's relative to other people. But he concludes by saying at least McKenna versus Clyde Wells, for example, had the wisdom, the foresight, and the dignity to recognize when he had made an error or a miscalculation in terms of the legislature's reaction to, agreeing to the accord, ratifying the accord. So he congratulates him, and he really says, you know, he would have been a great leader for sure. From Mr. McKenna's part, you know, I guess you could sort of wrap up his view of Mulroney by saying that if he was prime minister, he would make certain that the any talk of an inquiry into the Schreiber stuff would be put to rest. He feels that Mr. Mulroney is deserving of greater dignity than all the stuff he's been dragged through, and that pretty much McKenna feels that Canadians have enough information to make up their own minds about Mulroney after all the publicity.
When the Harper government came in and he was the ambassador to the United States he was appointed under Paul Martin, do you think he could have continued under the Harper government, or was the Harper government wanting to not have him there?
Well, you know, I don't think the email ever came or the call ever said, Mr. McKenna did not need, didn't need a silver bullet to tell him to go. I don't really think he could have because, his operating style was not a good match for Prime Minister Harper's, obviously. Mr. Martin was prepared to let him be his own man, and most of the MO of the PMO, since the Prime Minister Harper was elected, has been that it's not, you can't be your own man and be ambassador or be a minister in certain cases. So he would not have reveled in the control factor there very much.
After the Chrétien years and those years of his time in office, did McKenna change the U.S.'s, Americans' view of Canada?
He certainly had the formula, he and the team that he had formed around him, which they referred to as F Troop, as in Frank. They had the formula that I believe that they could have, and he had begun to do so, but, you know, within 12 months, it's pretty tough to change the public viewpoint. But I certainly think that the formula was there, and he was on the attack using media that was instrumental and that did penetrate into households, both in Canada, by the way, and in the United States, so whether it was Fox or CNN, and the leading personalities of those networks. And if you can get enough airtime with those leading personalities of Fox and CNN and public radio and so forth, then eventually you're going to create an impression on Americans which at least causes them to give pause and think about Canada differently. Even if you can't convince them that Canada's healthcare system or is a good thing or that there is good border security between Canada and the U.S., you can at least give them pause to analyze it. Versus the traditional mantra, which is held by Americans, which are stereotypical views, which others have not been able to change. So he had the formula, but his time was cut too short.
His relationship with the Bush administration was what? You have this great story about Rice, Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State at the time, and whether she would have met him to accept his credentials.
Yeah, well, that was a result of the ballistic missile defense debacle. He got caught in the trap between Minister Pettigrew and the Prime Minister's office and so forth. So, you know, really, Secretary of State Rice had to take it out on McKenna by not attending this credential ceremony, but it really wasn't his doing, per se. And she didn't, according to one gentleman named Roger Noriega, who worked for her at the time, she didn't hold the grudge. In other words, she got that out of the way, and then between her and McKenna, they did work together, although McKenna does say that he worked at it probably harder than she did. So, but relative to the Bush administration generally, he has a certain degree of respect for the president. He has a lot less respect for the people he calls the dark figures, such as Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Cheney and Wolfowitz, for example. But he doesn't really group Rice into that lot. He wouldn't call her a dark figure as he would the others. The thing he notes about Bush, and keep in mind, they've been on the road doing these two-handed affairs where Mr. McKenna will introduce Bush and Bush will speak, and then they do a Q&A after. In fact, they also did one with Clinton. But he talks about Bush's lack of curiosity as a leader, which might be a shortcoming, which got him into some trouble.
Yeah. Then he comes back to Canada. And he gets a job at TD. You mentioned earlier that he would return to politics if the country was in crisis. Does that mean that this lack of interest, I guess, that he has in being sort of the leader of the opposition or in the Chrétien or Martinier's a sort of a political minister for New Brunswick, what does that say about whether he's willing to do the hard work on the federal scene?
Well, he was prepared, I think, to be a minister for New Brunswick, and he would have been a senior cabinet minister under Martin. There were some goings-on in the province that didn't make it easy for him to make that segue, so he just took his leave of it, and it involved another MP at the time in the Moncton area riding, and, you know, I don't think he wanted to come across during that time as being...
A carpetbagger?
Well, yeah, somebody was shoving somebody out of their seat, you know, a well-earned seat, and that person had been a minister federally and so forth, so, you know, he didn't want to take on that persona for sure. It's not a question of the hard work, it's a question of the type of work. You know, he would have been prepared, as he did in his premier days, or as he does every day right now, to go like almost 24-7 if need be. But he's only content if there's results being achieved, versus being in a holding pattern, if you will, which, you know, he believes the opposition position to be, if it's there for a long time, and with a string of minority governments, that threat existed that he could have been there for a long time. So he was less interested in rebuilding the Liberal Party as a task, less interested in being in that holding pattern, but if he had been Prime Minister, there's no question, well, anybody would attest to this that knows him even in the slightest, that his only concern about becoming Prime Minister might have been a risk to his own health, you know, because he just would have been insatiable.
And as a political observer, we should still watch him, right?
Well, you know, like I say, he's still. I just read a piece in the Globe and Mail today by Lawrence Martin, which he leads the story off relative to Ignatieff by talking about McKenna's accurate quote that the Ignatieff needs to start treating the Conservative Party. This is McKenna's quote, not mine. Like a bunch of thugs, like the bunch of thugs that they are. In other words, that Ignatieff and the Liberals have not been gritty enough, but that they've been too soft. So he's, you know. But it's interesting that Martin picks up on what McKenna thinks and uses it over what Ignatieff is doing. I just think it's an interesting treatment and contrast, and it just seems to continue to occur. So it's not just that certain of the public are remain fascinated with McKenna. The media are still fascinated with what he thinks and has to say as well.
Other than your tourism work, are you going to work on this McKay book?
No, I believe that in that particular case, access to Mr. McKay would be essential to doing it properly, and he's declined that opportunity for the time being, and so I'm looking at alternative projects, and, you know, there's lots of interesting people out there. Not necessarily every one of them having the gravitas of Mr. McKenna, but, you know, I'll find some subjects and some topics that may not even be political in nature, might be more to do with, it could be any area, it could be crime, could be politics, whatever.
Congratulations on writing this book, Harvey. It was a fascinating read.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
And continued good luck with it. The website is harveysoller.com. The book is called Frank McKenna Beyond Politics. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Harvey Soller on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plana.